Hey, what's up? So today we are going to be talking about what's actually working in attribution and incrementality testing in 2025. So that is definitely a hot topic at the moment. I've seen it all over LinkedIn. Everybody's hating on first and last touch attribution. Everybody hates multi-touch attribution. Everybody's talking about media mix modeling. So it's definitely a hot topic at the moment.
Got the right ingredients for revenue growth. A pinch of effort and a dash of hope won't cut it anymore. Grab your utensils. You're about to get some high-performing marketing recipes. Welcome to Client Boost Kitchen.
So there's going to be three kind of core things that you guys are going to learn today. So number one, why attribution alone won't tell you what actually works. You are also going to learn the importance of regularly testing new ad creative to fight ad fatigue. And then finally, real examples that change the direction of media strategies from some of these different attribution methods. So our guest today, a special guest from the Client Boost team, but probably one of the most knowledgeable people on everything to do with data tracking and measurement that I've worked with in my career. Thank you for coming on today, man.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk about this.
For sure, for sure. So before we get into some of the kind of topics, you just want to give everyone just a quick introduction to yourself and what you do here at Client Boost?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm Reese, and I'm the director of BI here at Client Boost. And so right now, I lead a team of myself and two other people, and we focus on really everything from online conversion tracking to CRM configuration, and then even going into server-side tracking and reporting, all to make sure that we can set folks up with the best data infrastructure possible so that their media spend is allocated in the most efficient way possible.
I love that. I think my POV is that you guys are the unsung heroes of Client Boost, and also just the data teams in general, the unsung heroes of every business that they're in. And it's interesting to me. I was on a different podcast today and got asked a question like, what's the number one mistake that businesses make, and going into the future, what do you think's the number one thing that they should be focused on? And my answer was tracking 100%. I think for me, being in a position where I've been part of like the client team and also the sales team, so kind of, you know, conducting audits and stuff like that, I would say 80% of the time, clients are coming to us, and probably the number one reason that their ads aren't working is just really, really poor tracking setup. So they, one, can't measure stuff properly to actually know what's working, but two, then can't even make, you know, proper decisions because they don't have the right data to be able to make decisions based on what's actually working and what isn't.
Yeah, I believe it.
Cool. So with that, let's hit the first topic of the day here. So your attribution is lying to you. I actually did a post on LinkedIn about this recently. That's 100% accurate. Reese, what's your POV on this?
Yeah. So we're starting off with a kind of a spicy claim here. And so I would say maybe another way that we could say this is like it's lying to you, but maybe it's a lie of omission, or at best you could say it's a biased guesstimate on the platform's part. And the reason why I say that is because it's always not so much like the platform's lying to you out of malice, because I think sometimes we get into this space of like, oh, you know, Facebook is exaggerating how many conversions we're getting, and so like the platform itself is untrustworthy. And I don't think that can be the most useful approach to take to it, but I do think what's happening is the platforms can't see into what the other platforms are doing. Facebook doesn't know that Google Ads contributed to a sale involving the same customer. And, you know, even if we go to a more neutral-ish platform, like GA4 doesn't have Meta's view through attribution capabilities. Like if you have 7-day click, 1-day view attribution in Facebook, or even 1-day click, 1-day view, GA4 doesn't know that someone saw an ad and then later converted. And we don't know how important the view was in that person's conversion process. And so the reason why I mention all that is because a lot of times when we see misalignments between what the platform is telling us as far as how many conversions we got or how much revenue was driven. And we weigh that against something like Shopify, that's kind of like our actual source of truth. If we see that Facebook is over-reporting, for example, then it's kind of like we need a lot of something I hear often is we need multi-touch attribution reporting to help us solve this gap. And I think that's a completely normal thing to ask for, but I do think that it poses some challenges of its own in kind of giving us certainty. Because here's what could happen. It's like, let's say we put together some beautiful multi-touch reporting from GA4, and we unpack every session for every visitor, and we stitch all of them together. And that's something that, assuming everyone accepts cookies and all of that works out fine, like that's something that's relatively feasible. But what do we do if Facebook is the second out of 9 touch points for someone? Or what do we do if it's the 10th out of 10? And so we kind of get into this challenge, I think, especially the more complex someone's customer journey is, or like the more marketing channels you have, because the more channels you have, the more touch points there are going to be. So when these journeys get more complex, how do we value them? And how do we actually assign an ROI figure back to, you know, what ends up looking like a sort of attribution spaghetti? And so that's really the biggest reason why I think attribution, even when we fully unpack multi-touch, is not going to be our biggest ally in unpacking the value of each channel.
I love that metaphor of attribution spaghetti. Very, very, very apt for the Client Boost Kitchen
podcast. Yeah.
I think something I wanted to dig into a little bit before we move on to one of the other topics there, and this is something that honestly I haven't fully figured out what my own POV on this, but just something that I'm starting to think more and more, and this is especially so maybe more on the B2B side, is that I think there's maybe to some degree, and maybe multi-touch probably can't help with this, and I'm sure you'll touch on some methods that can help with this, but there's probably also an element of some of these ad platforms maybe over-reporting from a direct conversion perspective, you know, from like a direct response perspective. But I have been thinking more and more lately that they're probably under-reporting in terms of a long-term perspective. And I think about, there's definitely examples of purchases I've made that I didn't convert directly on an ad, but I just remembered a company because I'd seen like 700 YouTube videos that were unskippable and like 50, you know, Instagram ads or whatever, and had seen them pop up multiple times on paid search. So do you think it's also the case that they're like, yeah, and to some degree they're over-reporting, but there's probably also to some degree like an under-reporting of value too?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that touches really well on kind of what I think of as like the double-edged sword of attribution, which is that I think in most cases have this inherent struggle with like, is the platform like overcounting or is it undercounting? And I think the overcounting issue is usually easier to solve for, at least in the short term, because that time to conversion is always going to be proportional to how complex of a conversion action we're talking about and how much decision making goes into it. And so like if I'm buying like a $20 toy for my daughter, for example, that's probably going to have a pretty short path to conversion. Like I'm not going to spend a lot of time debating whether I should make that purchase. I'll probably just do it. On the other hand, if it's something way more complex, like choosing the right daycare for my daughter, that's a much more complex decision because it's going to affect, you know, both of our lives on an ongoing basis for a while. So I'm like, I want to make sure I do that right. And most likely that latter scenario, it's not going to be like a, you know, I click one ad, then I submit their form, visit, and we're done. It's probably going to be like, I'm going to read like materials about them. I might look at other folks' reviews, watch stuff on YouTube. And I would say that tying back to like, you know, something of a lie in attribution is that, you know, most likely if folks have some buttoned up marketing going on with these daycares, there's going to be a platform that is probably going to confidently take credit for my conversion at some point. But was it really that platform's sole involvement, or even like a generous fractional involvement that led to my conversion? Probably not. It's probably something more complex. But that is why, like, we'll kind of get into the solution, or what I see as the solution to this, pretty soon. But yeah, the idea that attribution can kind of give us these reliable, simple answers, I think, is something that we kind of over exaggerate to ourselves a little bit.
Yeah. I would fully agree with that. I think it's so complicated that trying to distill it down and simplify it too much is like such an expensive mistake to make, right? So yeah, cool. Let's move on to some of the solutions then. So first one here. So you're not testing what matters. What does this mean, Ruth?
Yeah. So in the opening slide, you know, it talked about this from the perspective of creative testing, but I think I'm actually going to talk about this from the perspective of channel testing instead, because I think the financial implications of that one hit a little bit harder. And I remember, especially several years ago, I feel like I was kind of seeing a frenzy of e-com businesses wanting to test new channels, kind of like in the time like leading up to and during COVID, where TikTok was a new up and comer, Snapchat was having a sort of a revival. And I think just kind of along with the creative renaissance feels like a little too fancy, but I do think the interest in those platforms kind of sparked a renewed importance around video creative, which I think then kind of gave some halo to YouTube as well. And so folks were so eager to just kind of branch out into these platforms to see if they could rev up their growth even faster. And back then, I didn't realize how ineffective an approach this was. And I wish I would have known then what I do now. But common approach here to test a new channel is, you know, let's throw a small budget in there, target a broad national audience, and see what happens. And it's such an ineffective way to test out a channel for so many reasons. But the first one, again, going back to the attribution piece here, is that a lot of the success of these channels was judged really only on in-platform numbers. You know, does our Snapchat ROAS look good? Does our TikTok ROAS look good? And if not, after a, you know, short while, scrap it. If it does, keep running it. Now, the problem is you don't know why the in-platform numbers look good or look bad. And so if they look good, for example, and if you're targeting broad audiences with no exclusions, then what if the numbers happen to look good because you're showing ads either to returning customers or warm visitors who might have just happened to see an ad on their path to converting anyway, which is something that when the numbers are overreported, I hear a lot of clients get concerned about, is like, you know, would we have gotten this sale anyway? And it's a good question to ask. And it's one that I would say that has kind of been hard to answer until now, but I want to kind of share what I think is the more effective method of testing here, which is to basically, instead of just targeting broad national audience, you want to define a test and control group in terms of specific geos. So that could be metro areas, it could be states, could even be more specific than that. But the idea is that you divide up those two pools into geos that are like roughly in parity with each other, just in terms of sales volume and ad spend, things like that. You want to make sure that these are two fairly similar groups. And so at that point, in your control group, for example, like let's say you're testing TikTok, then your control group, you'll just continue to run things business as normal, no change whatsoever. In your test group, on the other hand, this will be your group of states or metro areas that do get exposed to TikTok. And so, like I mentioned earlier, our goal here isn't to see if the numbers look good or bad necessarily in the platform. Our real goal, the reason why we're getting into a new channel, is because we want to see if it's going to drive more value for the business. So that means if we're a Shopify brand, let's say, we probably want to measure something like new customer net sales, So net sales from Shopify, that just means it's our gross sales, how much revenue we're generating, minus discounts and minus returns, because we want to account for those extra costs. And then, of course, we want to make sure that this is specifically for new customers, because, you know, most of the time, if not all the time, our paid media efforts, the goal of that is to help us acquire new customers. And so to give a little plug for ourselves, we created a dashboard that lets us see, like, what does our new customer sales look like over time in our control group? What does it look like in our test group? And then what does the change in those two groups look like over time? So, like, is our test group showing a noticeable lift over our control? Is it flat? And so in this case, if it's flat, then TikTok didn't really add anything. But if it's going up, regardless of what the platform itself tells us, that means that we're seeing a lift in new customer activity, whether it's more direct or indirect. And so limiting it to those specific geo areas gives us a measure of control, but also a measure of comparison, so that we can kind of isolate just down to that one variable. Is this moving the needle for the business?
Yeah, that's actually super smart. So there's two things I want to just kind of like clarify on that. So in theory, I want to check my understanding is correct here. So if we were to run a small geo test, and maybe if we say we're targeting like the whole of the US, for example, and we were to just pick, okay, we're going to run a geo test in New York State, for example, when we run that, we're not necessarily looking for the platform showing us like more conversions directly attributed to that campaign. But if holistically as a business, we've seen maybe a 20 to 30% lift in inbound or sales or whatever the case may be from New York State specifically above everything else, then we can be pretty confident that that activity is working, even if we are or aren't seeing that reflected in the data within the platform itself.
Yeah, that's the idea. And I would say, especially in that context, you know, in this case, it may mean a longer testing cycle, but and I would say that the test cycle should be aligned with, you know, your time to conversion. And if it's a short time to conversion, then at least allow a couple or a few cycles in there. But I would say in the example you mentioned earlier, you know, if there's a longer term effect that we might get out of a channel, if we run our test long enough to experience that, then yeah, like this gives us the chance to see, regardless of like, you know, if the platform is behind or not, is it contributing to some lift?
Okay. And so I want to kind of touch a little bit on how that can be relevant to the B2B audience too. So what I'm thinking with like B2B audiences that, you know, especially if you think more high ticket companies, there's longer sales cycles, for example. And so when you were to run these, I feel like, would it then also be the case that it doesn't necessarily just have to be a geo? So if we were to say, for example, maybe a platform like LinkedIn, and we were to take a specific segment and say, okay, instead of experimenting, because it, you know, the total pool of available prospects is so small, we can't hyper-focus on a geo, but maybe we can hyper-focus on one industry or one job title, for example. And would the same principles apply then, where it's like, okay, we'll run an incrementality test on this one industry or this one title. And then what we would expect is that, you know, like either pipeline or, you know, free trials or whatever the case may be for that specific business. And you can just measure the impact of the ads in kind of the same way.
Yeah. So there's a couple ways that these kinds of experiments can be designed. Like one method is geo. If we're looking at something that's kind of like more specific to a type of audience, then it is possible to do what you could call an audience split on that as well. So like if we have our list of like, let's say 1,000 people that we'd want to be going after, and we want to see a certain approach works better with those folks than what we're doing currently, then we can say, okay, well, let's randomize members of this audience. Whichever one kind of gets our randomized flag, then those people will be in our test group. The others will be in our control group. When doing some kind of audience split like that, the most important thing is just to ensure that folks are going to basically between like the test group and control group, that it's kind of like an even distribution of people who would have a roughly equal chance of like being exposed to your new creative or whatever it is. The main thing to ensure there, and kind of like the reason why we would turn to geo splits in some cases, is just to ensure that, like, you know, you wouldn't want like maybe half of your test group to kind of end up receiving like all of the marketing just because they happen to be the most active on the platform or something like that.
That makes a ton of sense. So do you, I assume you still see a place for kind of, I would say, like, for want of a better term, like old school attribution methods, but it's definitely, it sounds to me like the consensus is that's maybe a dangerous way to be measuring marketing on its own, at least. Is that kind of like a fair assessment?
And that's a really good question. And so that actually brings us to one of my favorite phrases and something that I've been saying more often lately. But
yeah,
my thought there is use in-platform numbers for in-platform decisions and use business level numbers for business level decisions. And so incrementality testing, for example, like we've been talking about with like audience splits and geo splits, the value there is that it helps us kind of take the impact of these in-platform or even like, you know, across platform decisions that we're making if we're adding in a new one. It helps kind of connect those decisions to the business level data in a much cleaner way because we're isolating for that variable specifically and kind of creating measurement around our testing control groups. Now, I think the area where it gets trickier is kind of like, you know, if, for example, like we have three different ad platforms that are all telling us, you know, this platform is doing well, and they're kind of all competing for marketing dollars under the same budget. You know, it's kind of like if your GPS gave you three conflicting stories about how to get where you're going, which in a way sometimes kind of happens with like the Google Maps alternate routes, depending on where you are. But I think in this case, like, you know, you don't want your, it's one thing to end up being like 5 minutes late somewhere, but I don't think you want your budget to be under the influence of three totally different perspectives with their own vested financial interests. And so actually, I think this is a good segue if you want to go to our next slide here.
Yeah, absolutely. So ROI is not the same as ROAS. I love this. I don't know if you've had much interactions with Kyle on the paid strategy team, but he's been posting a ton of content on LinkedIn at the moment about how ROI and ROAS aren't the same thing.
Yes, yeah. And, you know, I have been talking to him, and it's been fun to share some of this stuff with him because he's got a ton of interest in it. And it's been fun to kind of share some of the earlier stuff with him and his clients as I've been building out these pieces. But yeah, you know, ROAS is, you know, usually an in-platform number. I suppose it doesn't have to be, but at the end of the day, your CFO is probably not measuring you on ROAS. It's more about like, you know, are you, you know, multiplying the investment into your marketing budget back into the business? And these screenshots are from a tool that I've been using to basically measure ROI by channel, which is Google's open source MMM tool, Meridian. And what's nice about this is that kind of talking about like the attribution spaghetti issues from earlier and like, is this channel overcounting or is it undercounting? Meridian really helps us kind of cut to a much cleaner answer on those questions. And basically, the way that we approach this is rather than relying on like conversion data from any specific platform or anything like that, you start with like, what is the result that you're optimizing for? So it could be closed won revenue. If you're a B2B or even B2C lead gen brand, it could be pipeline. If you're an e-commerce brand, it could be new customer net sales. But basically you feed that number by week into the Meridian model. And then alongside that, we have to give it as much data about our marketing context as possible. So that means like for every channel, including offline ones, if you have good data for those, it's definitely easier with the online channels because we can just pull the data we need for those by week, but it would be impression and spend data for each channel. So now kind of picture like this, you know, we're basically creating and because it takes data for the model to learn about 2 to 3 years of data. So just kind of picture that we're creating hundreds of snapshots of like you know, we spent this much on these channels. They served this many impressions. We made this much money. Now, that alone is a decent start, but there's other factors too that help the model give us a better result. And so, like, you know, was it a big sale day? Like, was our discount rate higher than usual? Was it Black Friday or an otherwise big holiday? How does organic search volume trend alongside this in direct sessions? You know, can we include Google Trends data that basically shows demand for our category or even our brand on a more neutral footing? And so basically you package all of those things together, the model will learn over 2 to 3 years of that data and basically tell you, you know, you spent X amount on this channel, or actually it won't really tell you your spend, but based on what you did spend by channel, here's your ROI by channel. Here's where you could spend more based on your saturation in that channel. Here's where you should spend less because you're already oversaturated. And basically you get this calibrated mix of, like, you know, which channels are driving the most revenue, or basically your target metric that you upload to the model. What's helping you get there the most efficiently? What's not? And can you increase spend in areas that are effective?
I love that. So it sounds to me like the difference here between this kind of Meridian model versus kind of classic attribution is that classic attribution is oversimplifying marketing to produce a simple number, whereas this is accounting for complexity to produce a simple number. So it's like you feed it complex data and then it's able to give you like a very data driven, but then like based on actual reality as opposed to this kind of fake linear buyer journey that just doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a good way of saying it. You know, a tool like Meridian, even though the inputs themselves, you know, are kind of simple on the surface, it does let you do a lot more to account for, you know, the complexity of, like, you know, these different and most likely overlapping interactions across touch points people have. And even for, like, the, you know, cases you've mentioned earlier where it's like, you know, we have a long lag in our sales cycle and some of the effects are felt a little bit later. Meridian's model does even have parameters in there where you can basically bake a lag into the model so that it's not looking at stuff on an immediate basis, but could be evaluating things 2 to 4 weeks out or whatever it is that you need to enter into it.
Yeah, I love that. So I do think that to me seems like one of the biggest risks of attribution is it tries to measure a lagging activity. Like, marketing is a lagging like activity, right? As opposed to sales, which is more of a, you know, a real-time activity. And it feels to me like it tries to measure a lagging thing in real time, which is always, I've always thought that's not quite right. Because if I just think about Client Boost's own marketing, for example, so we have Google Ads, for example, you have from click to conversion, it's like 20 days. And then from conversion to closed one, it's another 60 days. And so in theory, like when Google only has max 90-day attribution window, if you say that the average sales cycle is 90 days, potentially 50% of people that click an ad might not get recorded, right? And so that's a risk factor. And then I think about paid social where it's even longer. So we don't even have access to the click to conversion data on paid social. I think you probably get it in Facebook, but you can't get it in LinkedIn ads, which is Client Boost's main channel at the moment. And so the only thing we know that is once somebody converts from LinkedIn, it's then another 100 days before they become a client, right? And so trying to measure those in real time where you say, okay, if we put this much money into LinkedIn and ads now, we'll get this much back now. That's just not going to be the case. And on the same vein, this is a mistake that we actually made ourselves recently, which is, you know, we were on kind of a drive to just increase, you know, profitability of all ad channels, recognize some areas to shave off efficiencies. And we actually had like a 3-month period where it looked like all these efficiencies were performing insanely well. Like CAC had come down from like $2K down to $500, which it had never been before. And then what we realized actually was we just hadn't factored in lag, and then almost exactly like 100 days later, then we suddenly see the pipeline starting to slip. We're like, okay, we actually need to reinvest in those channels because we've almost done an accidental kind of incrementality test to some degree, right?
Yeah, and you know, that actually tees us up beautifully for the next slide.
Oh, let's do it. Let's do it. Yeah. So what do we have here? You can't optimize what you don't measure. I love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, everything that you said, I think, describes my exact intention with this screenshot and metaphor that goes along with it. But if you're a ship at sea, for example, a change in course of just a few degrees, you know, it's kind of funny. I didn't really intend for this to be the case when this popped into my head, but there's the most famous case of this kind of accident is like Christopher Columbus thinking he reached India when it was actually the Americas. I don't know if he was off course by only a few degrees, but my point there is that being just a few degrees off course can mean the difference between reaching your destination or remaining in the middle of the ocean or ending up somewhere else entirely. And I think, you know, the example that you shared is kind of like that in a way where it's like, if you have data that feels reliable for decision-making on the surface, but is actually missing just a little bit of the context or is in some way just a bit removed from the truth of the business, then that's exactly how you can end up off course. And again, I think the root of that comes from using in-platform numbers to make business decisions.
Yeah. That's it honestly as well. I think when you just think about it, it seems like such a strange approach. Like you're going to put the long-term profitability potential of a business on a figure that, you know, quite transparently Meta and Google will tell you that it's not 100% accurate. You know what I mean? Like nobody's acting like that's the right metrics to even optimize against to some degree.
Yeah. You know, and that's why I think for folks who've never done one, doing an MMM audit just to kind of get an idea of where their platforms are at, especially if they've never done it before. If you're using three or more channels and you've never done one before, then it's probably time to do that just so that you can get an idea of which channels are actually yielding the most ROI. Because chances are at least one of them is probably not where you think it is. And to that point, you know, it's just in terms of staying on course, I would also say that it's not even like a one and done kind of thing, like doing MMM refreshes, like at least on a quarterly basis, just to kind of ensure you're staying on track, I think is a healthy move. But what I'll say too, is that I would say that with MMM, it's important to understand that it's statistical modeling. And so the benefit there is that it's agnostic from what the platforms tell us. And it's really just looking for patterns between our investment and sales that we're getting back. But I do think that's also where incrementality testing comes in, because we use the results of our MMM audit to come up with hypotheses. And then we use incrementality testing to basically validate those and kind of prove them against the model. So I will say that while MMM audits will generally be way more informative and valuable to pointing us in the right direction as far as where the business should go than the platforms alone will, incrementality testing will help validate results from an MMM audit. And I do think it's important to kind of use ongoing testing to kind of say, like, Meridian's telling us this platform isn't worth very much, or it's also telling us we could invest more in this platform. Then it's like, okay, great. Validate that with an incrementality test. That way we can be sure that, you know, this is a correct thing to do. Like, basically what I'm saying there is don't take it fully at face value just because it's MMM and we assume that it's even better than like attribution alone. The whole point to remaining on course, I think, is really to just incorporate ongoing testing so that you're validating decisions with your budget, especially if you're running with larger numbers. You don't want to just deploy a large chunk of budget and then wait until next quarter to see what happens, you know, when you run another run of Meridian.
And so there's another thing I'm thinking here, because I'm conscious like a lot of the people listening will definitely have that 2 year runway of data, which I think is probably insanely important to be able to, you know, accurately feed data into that media modeling mix. But let's say that you're in a position where you don't have that much data available to you, kind of in the reverse, do you think incrementality testing is probably a better place to start than kind of blindly trusting either in platform data or even, you know, I guess not in platform attribution tools like GA4 or other equivalents?
Really good question. So if you don't have at least 2 years of data, then I'm assuming it's because your business is 2 years old or younger. And if that's the case, then most likely your channel mix is not too big. So I'll kind of give an example that I remember from, I want to say a few years ago, but it's probably a little more than that by this point. But one of our clients who's still with us, a Shopify brand, they were much newer back then. At this point, I don't think they had 2 full years of data. But basically what triggered this was I was working with them. This was around like the time that like the iOS 14 tracking stuff with Facebook happened. And so like our Facebook conversion data was completely throttled, almost non-existent. And just to emphasize like how unfortunate the timing of this was, as her account manager and her agency that she just started working with, we were, you know, less than 6 months into working together, maybe less than three. And basically, like, I almost want to say, like, we start working together, and then a month later, iOS 14 happens. And then all of a sudden, our numbers in the Facebook platform look like garbage, which, of course, if you're a client, and you just hired an agency, and a month into working with them, all your in-platform numbers plummet, then you're going to say, like, these guys are awful. What's going on? I need to leave. But I knew that iOS 14 was causing our reporting to look distorted. So knowing that this is already removed from the truth, my first instinct at that point was, okay, like, what's Shopify telling us? Are we generating more sales? And so, of course, back, I'm looking at the new customer net sales because we're focused on new customer acquisition. And basically what I wanted to answer at that point was, how is this trending alongside our total ad spend? And the reason why, it's a pretty simple way to look at it. We're just looking at two numbers, really: new customer net sales, total ad spend. And in her case, that was still a pretty reliable approach, because at that point in time, Facebook, I keep saying Facebook, I should probably be saying Meta, but at that point in time, that was really her only acquisition channel. So it's like, yeah, you could be generating revenue like from email or organic search for your own brand name, but how are people getting on your email list, or how are people finding out about your brand name? Unless you just kind of ran into them on the street and had them sign up for the email list, they probably saw a Facebook ad or at least clicked one. So at that point, we started following the new customer ROAS pretty closely and the new customer revenue. And she could pretty clearly see, again, with Meta being the only real acquisition channel going on, that new customer revenue was going up, new customer ROAS was remaining stable. And these numbers were, you know, almost completely disconnected from what the platform was telling us at that time. But because it was what was actually going on in her business, we were able to kind of make it through that period of awful Facebook reporting. And so to the folks who don't have 2 years of data, I would say keep it simple. You know, just keep a, if you can, just keep a spreadsheet, you know, by day or by week, if you can. Just look at your total spend against your whatever your outcome metric is, like, you know, closed one, pipeline, new customer net sales, and just follow the efficiency ratio of those metrics. And if you do plan on launching a new platform, you know, if you can, like, segment by geo first. You know, there's more sophisticated ways of dividing up your testing control groups, but I would say having a method there is probably better than no method at all. But for those folks, like, you can still keep it simple. You know, what I mainly caution against there is just, you know, don't blindly assume that the in-platform numbers are as good or as bad as they say. And also, if you're launching, planning on launching a new channel or testing a new channel, don't do a broad national audience and take that for what it's worth either.
I love that. And what I like most about this is it's kind of like serendipitously aligned to the message that I have been promoting to most people on LinkedIn for the B2B market specifically, but for a completely different reason. So what I've been saying to companies is, especially the kind of net new advertisers, but even to some degree, people that have been advertising for a long time, is go after smaller segments, because actually what we find when, at least when we look at the kind of like demand gen data, is higher ad frequency, for example, and higher audience saturation is like the best way to improve the performance of ads from a kind of like incremental uplift perspective. And then I'm on the call with you today and hearing you talk about how to measure it. And I'm like, oh, that strategy is not only good from the perspective of it's just going to utilize your budget more effectively, especially for something, again, more on the B2B side, where you're probably fighting more for mind space, because it's much harder to get somebody to make a decision right now. Yeah, and it's kind of interesting. It's like, oh, that's the kind of like additional benefit there, is that you'll then also be able to directly understand incremental lift on your ad channels, because in theory, you should have a disproportionately higher number of prospects from this small segment than any of the other segments that could be potential users.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I want to highlight that what you mentioned there around frequency. And I think that's important, because I think sometimes we also get skewed ideas about frequency. Like, something that I've heard from many folks, or like a reaction I've heard from many folks, is like, oh, high frequency is bad. Like, after a certain point, it's diminishing returns. And usually it's kind of like, you know, if the frequency is over 4, then it's automatically bad and it's ad fatigue. But it's like, you know, is it? Like, do you really know that? And because there are, like you mentioned, there's plenty of cases where higher frequency correlates with positive results. And so if anything, I just wanted to highlight that, to kind of just destigmatize the idea that higher frequency alone is not a good or bad thing. Higher frequency alone does not mean that the ad is already fatigued.
Yeah, I think the way I've been explaining it to people is, because I think the risk is, and this is, I'm fortunate to have spoken with quite a lot of marketing leaders and business leaders over the past kind of 18, well, throughout my career, but definitely more so over the last 18 months. And they'll always say like, oh, I'm really worried that I'm going to irritate the audience. Like, they're going to get annoyed of the ads. And my response to that is always, it's better to have one annoyed prospect than it is to have 100 almost customers. Like, do you know what I mean? You would rather serve somebody one too many ads than one too few. And I think on the flip side, the annoyance thing isn't even such a bad thing. You know, I was on Facebook yesterday and I saw an ad for Motion, you know, the kind of project management, calendar management tool.
Oh, yeah.
And so they'd taken a comment that somebody left on one of their ads, which was, it was something along the lines of, I was getting so sick of Motion ads, but I eventually just decided to try the product and now I'm fully sold. I think it's the best thing ever. And that it just reminded me of this concept of too much frequency, where it's like, this was somebody who was actively annoyed by seeing these ads all the time, but to the point where they're like, okay, you know, fuck it, I'm just going to go and try this product because I've seen so many ads. And then they end up falling in love with it afterwards, you know? So it's like, is annoyance even a bad thing? I think maybe, but it's more the case, like, if you come to mind when that person's, you know, looking for that, to have that specific problem solved or looking for that specific product, then it doesn't really matter. And I think for most companies, you really need to be like a huge brand before you start getting obsessed with the diminishing returns of frequency. Because I guarantee most small companies do not even have close to enough budget to get to the kind of frequency that you're hitting diminishing returns. And I think, like, I've been reading a book on advertising recently, which I think it says the point of diminishing returns is about 4 impressions, but 4 impressions on social media is not 4 actual impressions, right? That could be 10 actual impressions where they only registered the ad 4 times. So it's complex too.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Very much agreed on the budget point there. You know, like if you're spending 20K a month, 50K a month, even 100K a month, unless you're targeting a very, very granular audience, like you probably don't need to worry about running into diminishing returns.
Well, a quick wrap up then. So tactical takeaways. So number one, start with audience-based or geo-based holdout tests before reallocating major budgets. Then we also have use MMM outputs to build stronger business cases for creative testing and scaling budget. And then finally, add seasonality and promo flags to your MMM data set to improve fit. I love this. Reese, is there anything else you would add to that before we wrap this one up today?
I would just emphasize, like, for the smaller advertisers out there, like if you don't have 2 years of data, or if you haven't been, you know, running your business for like 2 years, you still have a simple channel mix. Like, you know, I would say again, like use some of the simple measurement methods that we talked about and just kind of compare your outcome alongside your investment, your total marketing investment, whether it's one platform or even 2 platforms. What I would also say there is, you know, if you have a small marketing budget, don't spread it too thin by trying to get yourself into all of these different platforms, because you want to be everywhere that your prospects are. You know, it's better to be a regular in one place than to show up to 5 different places for 15 minutes. And so if you're doing that latter approach, you're really just kind of adding extra complexity and overhead to your marketing program. So focus on one, maybe 2 channels, depending on your budget, so that you can really isolate your revenue growth to one specific kind of activity. So I really want to emphasize that. I can't emphasize that enough. Keep things simple. Link the measurement between your marketing and your business. And it doesn't have to be super complicated. It can literally just be 2 numbers in a spreadsheet.
That's a great point to end on. Reese, I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Patrick.
Catch you next time.